Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. This week, we'll be learning how to produce trackers, a type of data journalism that visualises changes over time. Now that could be A&E waiting times in your area, house prices, or the performance of local care homes. Those are just a few topics that Scottish media company DC Thompson has been tracking in recent years. And while tricky to produce initially, once the hard work is done, they're relatively low maintenance, can be easily updated, and can serve as valuable evergreen content. However, its High Street Tracker is a slightly different beast, which looks at vacant units in now four Scottish cities, the latest one being Aberdeen, which was published just last week, and their readers love it. The murky world of property ownership has presented all sorts of new challenges for its trackers, and we'll be poring over those today with DC Thompson's Head of Data Journalism, Leslie Ann Kelly, and data journalist, Emma Sabiak. Stay tuned for lots of tips, tools, and tricks on creating these data-led investigations for yourself. Don't go anywhere. Leslie Ann, Emma, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. Thanks ever so much for coming onto the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
We're going to talk today a lot about the data journalism that you guys do at DC Thompson, but I thought I would start with a fun fact about the pair of you from your website. So Leslie Ann, I'm going to pick on you first. It says here, she will die on the hill that you can learn more about life in Scotland from the annual baby name data release than you ever will from, is it GERS? I don't know. Tell us more.
GERS. What, Emma, help me out with what that stands for.
Gross financial
expenditure revenue. Scotland. Yeah. It's essentially, it's a thing that's thrown around in the independence movement quite a lot for whether Scotland pays for itself or not. And it's just one of these, it's the most divisive bit of data that I can think of. But I love baby name data. Baby name data day is like Christmas in our data journalism team. So you can learn so much more about Scotland and the trends and what's happening in people's lives from that data than GERS or GERS, however you want to pronounce it, will ever tell you. Absolutely.
What's the most fun fact that you have about Scottish baby name data that comes to mind?
Yeah, I can already see Emma cringing. I'm not actually sure if this will be allowed to be run, but we ran an entire series on baby name data. There's 10 articles or so. On a deep dive into 50 years of Scottish baby name data. And the reason for that was that back when I was a baby data journalist myself on the newsroom, I was preparing for baby name data day one day, and I was rifling through all the data and I filtered it down to names that had only ever been used once in Scotland in that roughly, it was about 45 years at the time. All sorts of stories in there. So a Starsky but no Hutch, a baby Beyonce, two freedoms, I think it was, or one freedom in the year of the independence referendum. But then I found that in 1981, a baby boy had been born in Scotland and his parents had named him Shart.
No, surely not.
S-H-A-R-T. So when I got, you know, staffed up and had a data journalism team and I pitched this series of articles doing a deep dive, one of them was, what are the rules for what you can call your baby in Scotland? And I tracked down Shart and spoke to him and got a bit of the background as to how that had gone for him having that name growing up.
And that was allowed as a legal name?
Basically, Scotland is a lawless country when it comes to baby names. You can call your baby almost anything, get away with it.
And you said there was two people called Freedom. I mean, that's bordering on a bit cliche, isn't it?
It is a bit, yeah.
It's a bit rough growing up with that.
Yeah. A bit rough. Well, your turn, Emma. I've got here that you enjoy gathering data on even the most banal things, such as her vinyl collection and cafe preferences. Do you keep a spreadsheet? That's my question.
I do keep a spreadsheet. I have spreadsheets for almost everything in my life. And the vinyl one tracks everything from this, how much we spend on vinyls, and also has a custom code that allows us to even just track what we're listening to, just to have a end of the year Spotify wrapped for our own vinyl collection. So yeah, I do track everything I can possibly track with a spreadsheet. I love a good spreadsheet.
I mean, that pretty much sums up data journalists. Spotify Wrapped is not enough data for us. We need more.
How big is your spreadsheet at this point in time?
It's not too big. I mean, like the vinyl one, I think we probably have about 70 vinyls on it, but it's more, we've kind of slowed down ever since I added a cost tracker where we added the prices of each vinyl and saw the saw the investment we've made recently into vinyls, so we kind of calmed down in the amount of spending that we've been doing on that.
And how long have you kept it for?
The vinyl one has been going for about 3 years now.
Yep, nice.
So not too long. We bought the vinyl player not too long ago, but as soon as we did, I decided it all needed to be in a spreadsheet. It also allows us to track things like the distribution of female versus male performers and stuff, which I always say that we don't have enough women. So we need to, that's an investment we can do is female performers.
Nice.
Well, I've picked on the pair of you, and I will divulge something of my own, is that I keep two spreadsheets myself. One is for video games that I've played and one is for music. And it's more like a personal recommender system where I basically aggregate and weight the scoring based on the consistency of a music artist or something like that. So I've been doing that with a friend for a good few years. So, from one spreadsheet lover to another, kudos.
Yeah, we add ratings for everything as well, just to make sure you know what the top vinyls in the collection are and what most listened is.
Nice. Right, on to the real conversation then. The DC Data Journalism Unit, Leslie Ann, I understand that you lead that at the moment. Tell us about the setup there and the kind of work you do.
I do. So we have been going for, I think, since 2021, 2022. DC Thompson underwent a massive newsroom transformation, and I was essentially given a team at that point. Prior to that, I'd been a kind of solo data journalist and DC Thompson's first and only data journalist. And then the pandemic really kind of showed the value of data journalism to our publisher. So yeah, we staffed up. It's currently, which is very easy for me and the rest of the newsroom, two people called Emma. So there's Emma here and Emma Morris, who is not here. So we go by Emma 1M and Emma 2M is how we differentiate between them. But we work on a lot of things, we work on data-led investigations. We also love to track things.
Awesome. I mean, the trackers is, I think, the thing that I'm really interested to really dig in with you to today. I mean, I've seen trackers on the high streets and what's happening in the city centre, the performance of care homes, COVID, A&E waiting times, and a lot around health, cancer treatment, air pollution, house prices, a wide range of things. And I don't want this to sound like a really basic question, but why are these ripe topics for you to track at DC Thompson? What makes those good topics for you to, monitor and track in this way?
We have to look at what our audiences really need. And we very much like to provide a service for our readers for taking things that either the data doesn't exist, which is the case of our high street tracker, or the data does exist, but it's locked away in spreadsheets, or we add kind of extra layers of analysis, which is what Emma's done with our care service trackers, put them in a nice, easy to use way for our readers. And it also really becomes a very circular economy for us, because they are used as tools for our reporters as well. So for both our high street trackers and the care service trackers, we have additional data that is only available internally to our journalists, which is add an extra context for our readers that wouldn't happen at our competitors, because only we have that data. And I think as regional journalists, we have to really provide that service internally as well to prove our value, because we're the only data team in Scotland. As far as I'm aware, I'm very happy to be proven wrong on that, because we would like extra friends, more people to talk to and bounce ideas off of. But as far as I'm aware, we are the only data journalism team at a Scottish publisher. And I know that there's been cutbacks at a lot of other regional publishers, like the kind of Reaches and National Worlds, that have gotten rid of their data journalism teams. So for us, we're just always having to kind of prove that this investment is worthwhile by providing services. And it's just evergreen content that can always be linked back to. It builds up SEO authority over time, because it's just sitting there, it's being updated fairly regularly. Google likes that. People are clicking on it every day. Google likes that. So when our reporters are linking to it in their stories, it's providing them a nice strong internal link that they can use, which then in turn helps the SEO for their stories. That's the reason why we lean more towards this tracker style content of providing services for our readers.
Super interesting. And two super quick things there to pick up on there, Leslie Ann. I mean, one, you would welcome more, friends in the area that are doing this data journalism. I know data journalism is one of the more collaborative fields of journalism. So very much you wouldn't mind seeing a few more data journalism teams in Scotland.
Absolutely not, no.
And you said something else really interesting there about how often you update these tracker pieces. Is that whenever new data sort of comes to light, if they are from like public sources, or how often do you typically update these?
We have, I'm sure you won't be surprised, a spreadsheet that has a big calendar of right. when things are updated. Some of them are ad hoc, some of them, like the high street trackers, are updated sometimes daily. I updated Dundee yesterday when there was a bunch of new changes. It can be hourly sometimes. They're updated whenever our reporters, or we have in the articles a form for readers to get in touch with us. Sometimes, quite often, my husband, who works in town, will see things and let me know and I'll update things. So we get information from lots of different sources and update that constantly. And then there are other things, like for example the Any waiting times tracker that you've seen. I think the data for that is updated by the Scottish Government monthly, so that just pulls that data automatically monthly. We have what are called GitHub Actions, which go and look for the data regularly, and if it finds new data, it just runs it through a bunch of code and sends it straight to our chart tool with no intervention from us. So yeah, some things are monthly, some things are quarterly, some things are daily, some things are ad hoc. Yeah, but we have a big content calendar where we can see how often things are updated.
Do you need alerts to any that are going to be updated? I mean, are these things that you just know are going to be updated in time and you just know to go and look, or are you notified when any new data comes to light?
I mean, you can add things like trackers to websites if it's something like that. With GitHub Actions, I think that the schedule on that is it goes and looks for new data once a week, because sometimes they run their data off schedule, so it's not always like the first Tuesday of the month, or sometimes things happen. So we run it weekly. If no data is found, it doesn't make any changes. If data is found, it does. So that just happens automatically, and we only get notified if there are errors in the code, which does happen quite frequently when, for example, Public Health Scotland, which is the people who create that data, change a header, for example, on a spreadsheet, and then it throws all the code off, and then we have to go fix it. But the maintenance is fairly minimal on those. And then we have, like I said, the opposite end of the spectrum where it's fully manual. So when I say fully manual, the high street trackers are all run via Google Sheets. So we essentially, if something changes, we click a few boxes, and then those few boxes then go and trigger off another dozen changes, and then that automatically updates the maps and everything in the charts on our actual tracker page. So it's as automated as it can be when it's fully manual data.
And the name of that tool again that you use? What is it?
GitHub Actions.
GitHub Actions.
GitHub. Sorry, this is my Scottish accent not helping here. GitHub, like the code repository, like where people host code, they have this tool that is absolutely fantastic. A lot of newsrooms use it. You can essentially host your code in there. So we host our R and Python code in there. And the GitHub Actions, it's kind of like, for any programmers listening to this, it's kind of like a cron job on your computer, except it runs totally cloud-based, and then that stores the data as well within GitHub, and then just sends the data straight to our chart tool. The great thing about that is we love to be fully transparent with it. So at the end of every one of our NHS waiting times trackers, there is a link to our GitHub code repository where you can see every line of code that we use to run that. So if anybody has any issues with any of our analysis, they can go and pick it apart line by line, or alternatively, they can go and steal our code if they want to. Like, that's totally fine as well. It's fully open licensed. You can go and you can run the analysis yourself and make your own charts if you want to. But we feel like transparency and data journalism is really important. Yeah. So where possible, we like to link to our code repository so people can go and view that themselves.
Is it fairly easy to use, or is it fairly specialist?
I'd say you're probably not on GitHub unless you can code.
Yeah, fair enough. Emma, I mean, we're talking a lot here about the High Street Tracker, which has your byline on it. Wonderful job. Tell us about this piece. Where did the idea for it come from? Why did you want to look at this?
Yeah, I mean, the High Street Trackers have been something that the team has been looking at before I joined. So I joined about a year ago, and they just had launched the first two cities of that. So that was Aberdeen and Dundee. We now track half of Scotland cities after we added Inverness and Perth at the end of last year. So everyone speaks about the death of the high streets and what's being done for it. And there's all these sort of bogeymans that people bring up of why it's dying, whether it's pedestrianization or other things that people have decided are the reason. But really what we wanted to look at is that the case? What is actually happening? You know, are things getting better? Are things getting worse since COVID, etc.? So like it was a sort of a transparent look the high street. But in addition to that, what we've done most recently is also look at some of the owners of the vacant units. So each of these trackers has like a full capacity for us to expand analysis that's not there. So in their basis, they're just looking at vacancy and occupancy and the type of units that are available. And we've created that data. We can look at things such as the owners of those vacant units. So most recently, that was done for Union Street, which was about 39 empty units that have been there for as long as 17 years. In some cases, quite a few were actually empty for over a decade, which is quite a long time for a unit to just be stood there empty. What we did was look some data on the Scottish Assessor Association. So once again, this was quite manual where we were looking at each individual unit.
Is that a government body? Sorry, is that public data?
It is, yeah. It's publicly available data. It just depends on how often. So basically, the Scottish Assessor Association deals with rates and setting business rates. So that's why they keep track of the names of proprietors, and because they need to know who to charge the rates at the end of the month.
Right, that makes sense.
So we used their data for this specific case. Previously, when we were looking at slightly different information, we bought deeds for Dundee for some of the vacant units as well. But after that, once again, we were just manually looking into getting as much data as we possibly could on these vacant units. So that included us doing another census where we looked at this time the available real estate signs and whether they were actually being actively marketed. We did the same thing looking at them online and then also looking at these businesses that own all of these units individually on stuff like Companies House and just any information that we could possibly find from them, as well as reaching out to them with a bunch of letters.
Yeah.
Not many got a response, but the ones that did were quite interesting.
Yeah. I think what I really like about this is that it's very easy to relate to, because I mean, I have a local high street, and when I walk through the high street, there are these allotments that feel like they've been empty for forever. And there are some allotments that seem like they change every 6 months, and there are the mainstays as well. And I just think what it does is it grounds something pretty abstract in our minds and something quite quantifiable and real.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like specifically having them in the maps is something that people always seem to respond to.
For sure.
And just sort of visualizing that the red versus blue in the case of Courier articles of like what's empty and what's not. But the whole question of specifically who owns the vacant units, what are they doing, is such a commonly asked question, or just such an easy statement that a lot of readers will make when they read our general high street trackers. So we thought it is really important to actually look at what is being done with these units, because in some cases it's not necessarily for lack of trying that they're not being filled.
I appreciate you just touched on it a moment ago, but walk me through your process, if you would, from data set to, you know, the final product. What's your process, Emma?
For the actual high street tracker, what we do is we start off by deciding which high streets we wanted to look at. So what we did was we're using a local knowledge from reporters, or, you know, Leslie Ann lives in Dundee, so you know which streets are the most common streets. And then from there, we started off by just drawing them on a map. So using a software called geojson.io is the name of the website, we just drew out all of these polygons and created the actual trackers.
I don't think Emma's making quite enough of that. Every single unit on our high street trackers is hand-drawn.
Yeah.
Because there's not geographical GIS data available at the level that we needed it. There's building level data, for example, but a lot of buildings are split into three or four units.
Yeah.
So we needed the ability to be able to say that three of those units are vacant and one is not. I think there's almost 2,000 units now, and every single one is hand-drawn.
Yeah, there is.
In painstaking detail is what you're saying.
Yeah, online, mouse clicking points and creating a little box. Yeah. So each of those boxes had to be, and it's also like about referencing and making sure that you do have the right amount of units for each street, which can be complicated because a lot of the actual drawing is based on Google Maps. And then if a Google Maps is outdated, or if the street got pedestrianized, you can't really use it in the same way. So a lot of it.
So have you got the two like side by side, just making sure that you're drawing the right lines and
splitting it up into the right amount of units, what I would do each time is before I'd start on like a section of the street, count how many they are and try and like make sure that they fit into the exact sort of, or as closely as possible to the proportions that we did. And then every quarter now we still do a census of all of the data that's there. So we walk down each of the streets in each of the cities. In some cities, it's done by us. In one city, in Inverness, we have the Inverness team help us out and do the census as well. And then all of that data is inputted. But as Leslie Ann said, these things are literally updated on a daily basis. So that's something that we can immediately just put in if we know that it is confirmed as open or closed. From there, it's all about just linking all of the data. So we added in all of the information we could get from categories or subcategories. So we split it into food and drink.
Again, manually, that's not automated. That's all one by one.
Yeah, all of this data is us doing it by ourselves because the data didn't really exist in the format that would be useful to us. I mean, there's like occasional censuses done by the council in some of these areas, but it's not really something that's consistently tracked or really clear on sort of what areas are being tracked, because that's also something that we try to be very transparent on, where, for instance, some streets might not be tracked to the very end because they kind of transition into a residential area, like in the case of Perth. And then from there, it's all about getting what analysis we can. Leslie Ann's previously looked at the type of food and drink units, because we do have food and drink as a category, so it's really easy for us to now filter the data and add additional information, such as whether it's an Indian or Chinese wins in takeaways in Dundee or whatever the additional concept might be. And that's sort of similar to what we did in the case of this investigation into the proprietors of the vacant units. And that's when we went for the Scottish Assessor Association and added additional information for each of the vacant units, or the units that were vacant at the start of this month. Because that's the other thing about this data, is that it constantly changes. So it's kind of like we need to take, when we're doing this kind of specialized analysis of it, we need to take some screenshots essentially of this is what the data looked at like on that day, to give us actual time to go through all the proprietors like I did, you know? So
yeah. I mean, did you find what you were exactly looking for based on the data that was available?
Well, yes and no. We found a lot of what we're interested in, but Leslie Ann herself has said previously, like, it's a bit of a murky world in property ownership and in terms of these vacant units, because a lot of them have been empty for a really long time. And for some of them, the data isn't necessarily as up to date as we would want it to be. So we did have a couple cases of, after sending out the right of replies, which again was another reason why it was so important, is that sort of data assurance, because we had a few people come back and say, we no longer own that unit. And that's obviously not been updated from the side of these public sites that we're taking these from, even though it's the data that's available there. So in, I think it's maybe three cases, we also purchased the deed. And that's from the Registry of Scotland, and looked there to see if there is any information on the proprietor. But in the case of just one unit, there was actually no data at all that was verifiable in a way that we would be satisfied to actually use it, because the date and the deed obviously hasn't also been updated. So it might have been a case of it's been recently changed hands and they've just not updated all of this data yet. Or it's just someone's not updated the deed generally. So we're not really sure what happened with that unit, but considering it's only one out of 39, I think it was quite a decent result.
I mean, Leslie Ann, what Emma describes there is a lot of piecing things together, sense making, trying to go back and forth to just make sure that information is as accurate as possible. I mean, is that consistent with a lot of the other trackers that you're doing that are based on publicly accessible information, or is this, you know, a one-off?
This is the other end of the scale. The idea for the High Street Tracker actually came from, not really came from, but it came out of a desire to do something that was really manual and something that we could fully own, because we had done quite a few things that were automated and based on this publicly available data. So we wanted to do something that actually, could we build some kind of database or some kind of tool like that? And we kind of thought about it for a little bit, and walking from my house to the city centre and seeing where our newsroom is and seeing all of the empty units, that's kind of where the idea came from. But no, it's the absolute opposite end of the scale in terms of manual and automation.
So this is the most painstaking tracking investigation you've done to date then?
It's also undoubtedly our most successful. We won an international journalism award for it. We're shortlisted for the Future of Media Awards for it. It's the gift that keeps on giving, because we've got these base of the database of the high street trackers in the four cities, and now they are almost an infinite storytelling tool. We can, like Emma said, we can look at what's the most popular cuisine in each area from our food and drink outlets. We have a series going out next week that'll be out by the time this podcast comes out, on people were always telling us when we were talking about the high street tracker data, oh, I'd go use the high street more if more of properties, more units were independent businesses rather than franchises. So we've already looked at Dundee, what the proportion of independent businesses as opposed to big chains are. We're doing that in Aberdeen next week. We've done all sorts of kind of really bespoke analysis, the who owns Dundee and who owns Union Street investigations. So it's just, it's like a starting point that we can just keep building off with these bespoke analysis that really seem to have an audience, because people really care. Like you said, it's really relatable. People really care about what's going on in their local high streets. So I think the trade-off for it being really manual is that exclusivity of we absolutely own this. And I know for a fact that I was right that there is no other data out there like this, because I've been told from various people that they're using our data, including our local councils, because they do not have the same level of granularity of data as we've been tracking.
Totally. And if I could read you one comment from the comment section, someone says, I think this article clearly demonstrates that the owners are stuck with buildings they cannot let or sell. The rents asked are ridiculous. The footfall has collapsed due to the council driving people away. What to do, etc. I mean, it really seems to me that this is chimed with your audience in a way that they're now, you know, really reflecting on this and asking really important questions based on the piece of reporting you've done.
It also has done a lot of myth busting, especially the who owns investigations in both cities. And I think there was a lot of myths of the council owned all of these properties and we're in control of them and we're doing absolutely nothing with them. And I saw a lot of comments on the Facebook post on Emma's latest investigation of people realising that for the first time, that, oh, these are all mostly privately owned companies that are just letting these buildings kind of become derelict, not the council. The council don't have a whole lot of control over it. There's not a whole lot that they can do. So it is just, it's good for informational journalism as well, of informing people that how these things actually work.
Yeah. And I don't mean for a moment to downplay the complexity of any other of the trackers that you've done, but by comparison, a lot of the other ones have been more automated, mm-hmm. more straightforward. Is that fair to say?
I mean, they're straightforward ones they're running, definitely. The writing of the hundreds of lines of code, I'm sure Emma in her care service tracker would not say that that was necessarily a straightforward process. That took a while to get that code right.
It's a very good description to say that they're easier once they're running. Once they're published, absolutely they're less work than us, what we do on the high streets, because we do have to do the high streets manually, purely because that's not open data.
That's one of the benefits of it, is that I feel much more aware of the data because it's so manual.
Yeah.
There's just much more of a I think we probably tap into it much more for stories, because we're much more familiar with the exact ins and outs of it.
Yeah.
Because of the manualness.
So I understand that once you've done the hard wiring of putting these trackers together, they, to an extent, look after themselves. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Basically, unless they break, which does happen.
Well, that was my next question, is do they break?
Absolutely.
How does that happen and what do you do?
There's a lot of ways in which they can actually break, because all of the code is really dependent on the format of the spreadsheets when we first start working on them. And ideally, in most open data cases, they shouldn't be changing. They should just be keeping that same format and just be adding additional rows to it. And when that happens, they work perfectly fine because the code will be able to find what it needs to find. But we do add in error type messages to tell us when stuff like column names change, Because as soon as they do that, even just changing the name, it means that the code no longer knows what it's looking for. In the case of the Care Inspectorate one, for instance, which is slightly actually maybe just a tad more manual than the health trackers, just because the health trackers are actual open data links, so that we never have to update that link. Whereas we don't have that for the Care Inspectorate. So what we need to do is each month I just paste in the new link. So it does mean like there's a little bit more of, I can also see if something's changed, but at the same time, it's a very small bit of the process compared to what we would have to do if we were doing the whole analysis each month. So it has absolutely made it faster, but I know that each year I'm going to have to go into that code and update it because they will add in new financial years. So like they have the data that will be, for example, complaints up from 23, 24. Right. And that's something that happens quite a lot with the health trackers, is that they'll change a column name in the open data. And that means we need to go back in and see what exactly has changed and fix the code to actually be able to acknowledge.
I think for anyone who ever wonders why data journalists publish stories less often than reporters in the rest of the newsroom, it's this: we're probably fixing our code that has broken because of something like this.
So what are the stories left to tell, I guess, is my question to you in parting to the both of you. You know, you talked before about this being the only data journalism unit in Scotland. What do you think are the stories left to tell and to track in this way? I'll put that out to the floor, whoever wants to take it.
So I think there's really capacity for anything that touches upon people's daily lives is information they probably want to have. We've seen that with COVID, which is why the whole COVID trackers were such an important hit. And we see it daily with the high street trackers. People want to know what's happening around them, but they want to be able to access that information in an easy, accessible way, which is why we do the data viz. But I think one of the big things that we believe might be the next step is looking at some weather data as a really big future step, in terms of it touches both for our local audiences, but is also an important topic that you need to tell with data in order to be able to tell the whole story.
I've lived in Dundee for more than half of my life at this point, and I don't remember anything like the kind of storms that we've been having in the last few years, like storms that have done real damage to my property and like the local area. And we know from our audience data that readers really resonate with storm coverage and weather data, not weather data, but weather coverage in general. And there is so much weather data out there that what we're looking at is how can we build some kind of suite internally of weather data that we can tap into whenever we have some kind of storm, which is coming soon. It's coming up to storm season soon. But you can tell that we have no other data journalism teams in Scotland, and we're giving away our secrets like this.
Well, that was probably the most British answer you could have come up with, is something about the weather. So
we'll track queues next.
Queues.
People queuing.
Yeah.
We'll track the queues for the Oasis tickets. That can be our next tracker.
Hey, hey, look at this. Idea generation here and now. Anyway, thanks ever so much for coming on the show. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
My takeaway for today is to learn as you go. Something we ultimately cut from today's episode, just for time, is that Leslie Ann and Emma often do not have all the answers going into their investigations, whether that's a technical question or something they're hoping to find out. But there's nothing quite like learning on the job and when you need it to work, and that's ultimately what served them well and helped them know what to do when a spreadsheet breaks, and the like. It was a bit of a passing remark in today's show, but data journalism is a collaborative field, and if you want more pointers on how to get started, it might be worth getting in touch with the pair. We'll leave their socials in the podcast description. But what did you learn from today? I'd love to know. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter/X@JPGJournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week, though. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.